Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. In this episode, ISF CEO Steve Durbin speaks with commentator and policy analyst Michelle Walker, author of The Gray Rhino: How to Recognize and Act on the Obvious Dangers We Ignore, and her newest release, You Are What You Risk: A New Art and Science of Navigating an Uncertain World. Steve and Michelle discuss individual and collective risk appetite, the concept of a risk ecosystem, how to build a culture and team that can balance your organization's risks appropriately, and more.
So Michelle, it's lovely to talk to you. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk through some of the things that we're going to be covering off in terms of risk in particular. I'm very interested in talking about risk management and all of the different things that you've been covering off in, particularly in your most recent book, but also one of the ones you wrote before that. We'll get to that momentarily. But before we start, it would be really helpful, I think, for people listening here, if you could just give us a little bit of your background, tell us who you are and set the scene.
Sure. Well, I'm so glad to be here and really glad that you're interested. I got asked the other day by a reporter, what do I call you? I've seen you called an economist, a journalist, a consultant, a strategist, a speaker, a policy analyst, you know, an anthropologist. What are you? You know, all of those have some grain of truth, but none of them is exactly that. I started my career as a financial journalist and later became a media and think tank executive. And almost 6 years ago, I started working almost exclusively in risk with the gray rhino concept that I had coined in 2012 and introduced to the world in 2013 to help us to pay much more attention to the big, obvious, scary thing coming at you, and to remind people that we're much more likely than we think to ignore it, but we're not condemned to do so. So I wrote about that in The Gray Rhino that came out in 2016, and more recently in You Are What You Risk, which is a sequel of sorts to The Gray Rhino.
So let's go back to start at the beginning, I guess, with Gray Rhino rather than diving into the sequel. So a lot of people listening to this, obviously in the security space, you know, very familiar with the concept of black swans. We talk about those a lot in security, maybe not quite as familiar with the term gray rhino. So let's start there. What exactly is a gray rhino?
So I developed the gray rhino as a metaphor to better talk about this question. You know, why do some people see a big scary thing coming at them and do something about it? And why do other people not? It actually started in my former life, writing about the Argentinian debt crisis in 2000, 2001, when there were lots of warnings. You know, the debt's going up, the reserves are going down, the economy's going down, the math is really pretty simple. And there was a proposal by some very, very smart people on Wall Street to do a preemptive restructuring, which didn't happen. And that proposal involved probably about 30% of the debt being written off. And most creditors lost 70% because they didn't do anything in time, which is pretty bad math, if you ask me. And, you know, 10 years later, I saw very similar dynamics in Greece. But at this time, the entire euro was at stake. And so I wrote a paper that I presented at the World Economic Roundtable, which was a group that the World Policy Institute, which I was running at the time, did jointly with New America. And said basically, hey, Greece, learn from Argentina. Don't make the same mistake that Argentina did. And it was one of the first public calls for a preemptive restructuring. And in spring of 2012, late winter, early spring, Greece and its creditors actually came to an agreement that prevented a catastrophic, chaotic default and probably would have led to the collapse of the euro as well, and with much bigger problems. And so that spring, I'd been running this think tank for several years and was sort of at the point where I was ready for a reset button and wanted to go back to writing and really wanted to know, what's the difference? How come Argentina and Greece both saw this thing and only one of them did something about it? And I realized that not everybody geeks out on sovereign credit spreads the way that I do, but I thought that, who knew, right? but I did think the question was so important and so relevant, in fact, even more relevant, as I later found out, than I knew. I wanted to talk about it in an accessible way. My work in policy has always been around trying to take complex, geeky topics and make them relatable and help anyone, you know, not just policy wonks, to talk about them. And so this was very much what I was trying to do. And I'd been struggling with how to tell that story. And that summer, I was in my office with a friend, a corporate lawyer, very experienced and senior. And that's when the rhino came into my head. I'm like, you know, it's really big. It's scary. It's coming at you. Scary, like with a horn. And I thought, the rhino. Mm-hmm. And so he made a black swan joke, of course, you know, referencing the term that became big in the great financial crisis, the thing that's right. So improbable, unforeseeable, unimaginable. And so I thought, wait a minute, you know, there is a black rhino and there's a white rhino, but I don't really remember that much from my zoo visit in grade school. Let me go check out Wikipedia. And that's when I discovered that black rhinos are gray, white rhinos are gray, but that's not what we called them. And so it seemed to me to be a great metaphor for just how vulnerable we are to, you know, trying to ignore the thing in front of us. And, you know, some people talk about my work as a response to the black swan. And I mean, yeah, the idea of the color came from my friend's joke, but really the central idea was not about the black swan at all. It was about this question: why do some people see it and deal with it? And why do some people see it and look away or otherwise don't deal with it? And so that's how the gray rhino was born. And it was very interesting. When we first pitched the book proposal, a lot of American editors came back and said, well, why do we need a whole book about things that are obvious? It's like, if they're obvious, we're dealing with them. So, you know, this is not counterintuitive.
Right.
And I went, oh man, this is so counterintuitive. You don't even know it's counterintuitive. Like, they really didn't want to believe that we ignore obvious things. So in talking about it, I emphasized that ignoring part. And over the past several months, I've come to almost regret that, because some people have been saying that by definition, gray rhinos ignored. And that's exactly the opposite of my point. And, you know, we have the elephant in the room for that. You know, the thing that by definition, nobody pays attention to and that we normalize. And my point with the gray rhino is that, you know, when there's a big scary thing coming at you, you've got a choice. You either get trampled or you get out of the way. Maybe you let someone else get trampled, or you find a way to harness its strength and use that not just to avoid a risk, but actually to seize an opportunity.
Let's dig into that a little bit more. You make the point about Argentina and Greece. Why is it that some people do, I suppose, go into this state of denial, if you put it that way, you know, persist in the face of obvious risk, as opposed to taking what, after the fact, could be viewed as being a pretty obvious route? What's the root of all of that? Why does it happen?
Well, there's a whole book about it. You know, there was so much. But I'm trying to get into a small enough tidbit. But, you know, some of it is human. And that's part of my point, is that some people get very defensive when I say we ignore obvious things, you know, particularly Westerners, particularly Americans among Westerners.
Right.
And my point is like, no, I'm not criticizing you. I'm giving you permission to recognize mm-hmm. that you need a fresh look at obvious things. Our brain is hardwired to keep out scary information if it's so much that it's going to overwhelm us and we're going to collapse. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote about this just beautifully when talking about the five stages of grief, which I actually drew on a little bit, was inspired by when I came up with the five stages of a gray rhino. So some of it's a natural human response. Some of it is a group dynamics response, particularly mm-hmm. when everybody in the room went to the same schools and, you know, looks the same and studied the same things and comes from the same perspective, is that when you're in a group, it becomes socially very difficult to raise a point that people don't want to hear.
Right.
And it becomes even more so in homogeneous groups. So there's that part of it. There are also structural incentives, whether in, you know, how politicians get elected. You know, if your term is only for 4 years and you may or not be reelected, you don't want to take a seemingly hard decision to prevent a crisis, because people are really bad at counterfactuals. They don't like to think about preventing problems. It's really more in your interest to kick the can down the road and let the problem blow up for someone else. And, you know, we praise people for fixing problems, but it's really hard to praise people for preventing problems, because that involves a lot of counterfactual thinking and imagination. And we don't do nearly as good enough job at celebrating whistleblowers, at celebrating people who made difficult decisions to prevent problems. In companies, you know, you've got quarterly earnings. You've got shareholders who will just, you know, beat up your price. And if you're the CEO and your pay is tied to the stock price, you know, you are going to focus on the short term, and you're probably going to take some shortcuts that are actually going to hurt the value of the company and your shareholders and yourself in the long run. But CEO tenures are shortening, just, you know, like everything in the world seems to be shortening and going faster and faster and faster.
Right.
And so a lot of our incentive system is not set up right. And so I've also, in You Are What You Risk, taken a much more individualized psychological approach. Over the past couple of decades, we've seen huge advances in behavioral economics and behavioral science, you know, thinking fast and slow, the work of Daniel Kahneman and so many other people who I admire so much. And they talk about these natural human biases, but there's a new wave of thinking about that, which is that not everybody operates the same way under those biases. Not everybody has the same amount of loss aversion, for example.
Right.
And so what I've done now is kind of taking it a step further and looked at how group dynamics in your organization interacts with the greater set of societal values, which are then reflected in the policy environment, the risk ecosystem, as I call it, and with each individual's set of innate personality combined with experiences, combined with group dynamics, combined with habits and awareness of risk and the feedback loop that that creates. And, you know, I call that a risk fingerprint. Mm-hmm. And every person has one, every organization and every society. And so I look at how that risk fingerprint interacts with all of these other dynamics to determine whether you're going to get out of the way of the gray rhino or not.
Right. And this, I guess, is, you know, the sequel, You Are What You Risk, you know, the new art and science of navigating an uncertain world. So I like that blend of art and science. That for me is something that I've always been very sort of drawn to. I think that particularly in the security space, you know, we perhaps have a tendency to always focus purely on the science. But of course, as soon as you introduce people into the mix, as you've just been talking about, then for me, it all switches immediately into an art form rather than anything else. So I do like that title that you came up with there of blending the two things together. This notion of fingerprint at an organizational level, I'm interested in that because increasingly, of course, everything that we do in the corporate world is about risk management. And yet, if we bring it right the way back to security, and it's the point you just made that I want to go into in a bit more detail, a lot of security professionals would perceive perhaps that they don't get the credit, that they aren't rewarded for avoiding a breach, a loss of data. The light is only shone when the breach happens and it goes public and they then have to pick up the pieces. What are some of the things that you've seen as to how people can effectively encourage more of what I would call the art, more of the human piece, the reward element around, you know, anticipating and doing something to prevent a problem rather than just sitting back and waiting for it to happen?
What you express is so much in line with one of the reasons why I wrote the new book. I've given a lot of talks in Europe, particularly in the business continuity and disaster risk reduction communities. And so many people, risk professionals who are used to, you know, losing sleep over this kind of stuff, would come up to me and say, you know, this is so important, but risk tends to get shoved into a corner. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of boards or other executive teams will say, okay, we did our risk analysis and okay, that's it. And they were very, very frustrated that often the insights from the risk analysis didn't actually get put into action. Or right. There'd be people saying, hey, I'm here in my risk world that's kept in a silo, and I really need a way to talk to the other people in the company. And, you know, with information security, it's, you know, it's that one person who clicks on the phishing email. Mm-hmm. You know, and you really need every single person to be aware and responsive and to feel like they've got the power to do something about it. And that sense of agency is incredibly important. I've talked to so many people in companies who say, you know, I'm aware, all of my other coworkers on the front line are aware of these things, but how do we get these ideas all the way up to the top? There's like this sort of two-way information gap.
Right.
And that communication is so important. And it's a problem very similar to what I faced in the policy world. And, you know, you need the science to come up with the right policies, know, the right things to do, you know, to really do a strong cost benefit analysis, to analyze, to understand the implications of what you're doing. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Then it's the communicating that. It's the hearts, not just the minds. And that's really why I came up with the gray rhino metaphor in the first place. And it's why, you know, Aesop and so many other people throughout history have used animals or other metaphors as a way to communicate with people. Another thing that I found just fascinating while I was doing the research for this book, there were some studies the Risk Policy Working Group did in the US of different states and their mask wearing or their COVID responses. Mm-hmm. And one of their findings was that in many cases, people saw the risk of catching COVID and dying from it when you caught it as being much, much, much higher than it was in reality.
Right.
But they said that that perception didn't necessarily correspond to, you know, wearing masks and social distancing and doing the kinds of things that would protect you. What they found was that the messaging that was most effective in getting people to deal with the risk in front of them was to tell them, this is something that's easy to do. You can do yourself. You've got agency. You can do it at any time, at any day, and it works. So that combination of agency and efficacy. So that's hugely important in how risk professionals can communicate with people in the rest of the company, making sure that they know you are important. You know, you have positive and negative agency. You can either click on that phishing link or not. And, you know, you're important to this. And also that you have the power to do something. There's one woman who helped develop a whole risk program for her company. And she said she used the gray rhino in that. And she said she'd start going down the hall and people would poke their head out their doors and they're like, hey, I got a gray rhino for you. And, you know, kind of making it, you know, the right amount of fun and serious. You know, that communications right. part is just essential to everything, you know, whether it's policy, whether it's security, whether it's marketing or motivating your team or just about anything you do. And too often communications gets, you know, shoved in the corner, the opposite corner of the room from the risk management stuff. And they're both essential, but we don't appreciate them as much as we should.
I'd agree with that. And one of the questions that I've been asked a lot over the last 12 months, I guess, since everybody's been, you know, working from home and not able to, as you just said, stick their head out of the office door and wave at somebody is, how can we use some of those same techniques, but in a remote environment?
Well, we've heard so much about the learning curve of, you know, virtual interactions and Zoom and things like that. And, you know, the first step is obviously mastering the technical part of it. There's a great skit on Saturday Night Live, you know, right when everybody was starting to do all the Zoom about people, you know, figuring that out. But once you get beyond the technical part of it, you know, a lot of the communications principles are very similar. And a lot of that actually requires listening mm-hmm. more than most of us give, you know, give credit for. That goes to a concept that I talk about in You Are What You Risk called risk empathy.
Right.
Which is that, you know, you can look at your own risk fingerprint. You look at the things that affect how you deal with risk. And once you do that, you can look at the risk fingerprints of the people around you and understand why they are responding the way they do and what can make them more comfortable. You know, the risk fingerprint is interesting. I get asked all the time, can you change your risk fingerprint? And some of it you can't. I mean, just like the print on the glass and forensic investigations with all that black powder they put on, part of it is genetically ingrained. You know, your innate right. personality, that's like the whorls and the arcs on your finger. You can't change, except if there's a huge event, like you cut your finger or like you go through a traumatic experience, that is going to indelibly change the fingerprint. And how it changes it depends on all kinds of things, the people around you, your values, the habits that you developed. You know, if you're doing manual labor, you get calluses all over your hands. But if you are, you know, working some desk job and use all sorts of soft, sweet smelling lotion on your hands, they get, you know, nice and soft. Not to take the metaphor too far, but, you know, you get my drift that there are things that you can do to take care of your attitude. And part of it is simply being aware. There's a wonderful tool that I talk about in the book called the Risk Type Compass, developed in the UK by a group called Psychological Consultancy. which is based on Big Five personality types. And they look at how methodical or impulsive you are and how, you know, anxious or calm you are in face of risks. And they've developed several risk personality types around that, including how closely you hew to any of those types. I'm mildly intense, which I just love. It's such an oxymoron, right? But, you know, people come at things from different ways. Different things make people more comfortable or more nervous. And once you start understanding those things about yourself, it makes it so much easier to understand it with the people around you. For example, all these conversations right now about should my company require vaccines to work here? You know, one of the most important things is to talk to your employees. You know, who's scared of vaccines, who's got access to it, what makes them feel that way, what's important, you know, if you give them incentives to get the vaccine, is that going to work better than, you know, than the stick? How do they feel about the behavior of the people around them? One of the things that the past year has shown us is that your risk level depends so much on the people around you. And when I first started taking public transportation, it was probably about 6 months in to the pandemic, I took the bus down Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, and it was a beautiful drive. You see the lake, very calm. Everybody's wearing masks, no problem at all. A couple of weeks later, I took the L, our subway and above ground train system, and I changed cars 4 times because there are people with the mask hanging down over their mouth or no mask at all, or, you know, crowding together and yammering away. And it was a completely different set of behaviors of the people around me. And I did not take the L again for many, many months after that. And the same is true in a company. You know, what you do is listen, find out what the risk fingerprint of, you know, the group of people is. What are the risk fingerprints of the individuals? You know, why are they behaving that way? Sometimes people may do something that seems very risky, not because they are less nervous about it, but because their idea of taking control is just doing the riskiest thing they can, but that doesn't mean they're less anxious. So we've all got a whole set of different behaviors, and understanding the roots of those behaviors for ourselves and for the people around us opens up a conversation that's hugely important and can open up doors you probably didn't even know were closed in the first place.
And that's a hugely important point, I think, for security in general, because of course, security, I think for many years, you know, has tended to work in isolation. It's tended to work off policies, off processes, hasn't really looked at engaging to the degree that it has to today with people. And I think that very often when we talk about a risk appetite that exists across an organization, it's something that for some people is handed down from a board of directors. It's somehow created. But the best risk appetites that I've come across have been co-created across the organization because they've begun to understand how people might react differently from a cultural standpoint, for instance, from perhaps a departmental perspective. And so it's about bringing all of those things together, isn't it, that really gives you, I suppose, that insight that we're talking about here to arrive at a solution that is going to help you deal, I guess, with some of the challenges that are out there.
Absolutely. And a big part of it, too, is not making assumptions about what the people around you think about risk. I found that there's a lot of stereotyping. In fact, a lot of women and people of color have experiences that other people in decision-making positions make assumptions about them. I interviewed Genevieve Tiers, the co-founder of Sittercity, a year or two ago, was the woman who raised more money than anyone else in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And she said in the early days of company, she would have to go into fundraising meetings with who now her husband. So she wanted him there, but she felt it was important to have a man in the room because otherwise the funders didn't think she was going to take enough risks, quote unquote, which is kind of a crazy thing. And she said that she spoke with a lot of other women founders and they had very similar experiences. But you look at the research behind it, and there was one study I cite about they looked at, you know, how much capital people deployed, all sorts of, you know, risk metrics. And they said that women weren't actually that different from men, you know, if at all. Julie Nelson at University of Boston has also done a lot of work, looked back at a bunch of studies whose headlines were, oh, women are risk averse, which is a word that I actually hate and come to hate through the course of writing this book. And she said that in many cases, there were flaws in the analysis. In many cases, these assertions were made with the slimmest, you know, statistical evidence. And she also said that a lot of them would look at averages instead of ranges of risk preferences. And she concluded that men and women have about a 95% overlap in risk preferences, which is not much difference at all. You know, there are differences in certain areas in things like, you know, unprotected sex or speeding or things like that. You know, men do take more risks. But what's interesting is that in many cases, a guy who normally drives very aggressively will actually drive less aggressively if there's a woman in the car. So there's something about having people of different genders, of different perspectives around the table, you know, in a room making decisions. But also that women in high stress situations tended to make better risk decisions. And also that in hindsight, women were more accurate in evaluating whether their risk decision was a good one or not. There's also research that shows that women are more willing to take social risks in terms of, like, say, speaking up. And it actually is a bigger risk for women to do that than for men. I talked earlier about group dynamics and how hard it is for a single person who is, you know, different from the rest of the group to say something and get heard. In many of these groups, there is, you know, just one woman or just two women. And so in many ways, women are much more experienced in making risk decisions because there are so many situations that are riskier for them than for men. So I think that in many cases, women's risk abilities are way underestimated, but that also it's not just a matter of, you know, women or people of color or age, but it's the importance of having a variety of perspectives because people are going to see risk in different ways and they're going to be able to flag things that you might have blinders on if you're in a room with all of your college buddies.
And I think that's a really good point. I was going to just ask you, but you've answered it already, about the importance of this diversity in the group that is taking decisions around risk. Because at the ISF, you know, we spend a lot of our time increasingly now, in fact, focusing on working on risk management, risk assessment with our members. And the better outcomes, I would say, are the ones where we've been able to get a broad brush view across the organization, very diverse groups, different cultures, different genders, you know, all of that whole melting pot that you've just been talking about. And so I've actually seen some of the benefit of what you've been talking about here.
Yeah, and I think it's also a lot of times people will take, you know, gender or demographics or something as like a proxy for that person's risk attitudes. And there's so much of a range within each group that I think it's important to actually talk about risk head on. You know, to not just say, well, we've got women, so we've got a different risk profile, to actually talk about people going, you know, hey, what's the biggest risk you've ever taken? You know, here's a risk. How would you handle that? To have that open conversation about how people feel about risk, that's going to give you a big head start. If you get into a crisis situation or a big risk decision, you've got more knowledge about how people in your group are coming at it. And you can also correct if you need to. Like if you know that your group is a bunch of shrinking violets, you can bring in someone who's going to shake it up a little bit. Or, you know, if it's a bunch of, you know, move fast, break things people, well, you know, get a grown up in the room. You know, it's really that mix that's so important. And not just assuming that people think a certain thing about risk, but talking about it very, very openly. And that's a conversation that really, you know, risk professionals, I think, are somewhat aware of it, but it's not being held as widely or deeply as it should. And it can be hugely, hugely helpful.
Some great insights there, Michelle. What I'd like to do now, I've never done this before on the podcast, so I hope you don't mind being a bit of a guinea pig, but knowing that you were coming on and we were going to be talking about risk, I did ask some of our members if they had some specific questions that I could put you. So I've got about three or four down here. So the first one I've got is from somebody who's actually in corporate risk at a large bank, interestingly, in Germany. And the question is, are there risks that we should celebrate and embrace? Or is risk inherently threatening?
I love that. And the answer starts with, it depends. It's actually, sorry. But it actually goes back to the fingerprint, is that, you know, you ask people about a risk and they see very, very different things. Some people only see the peril and the danger. They're like, risk bad, ooh, scary. Some people only see the upside, the opportunities. You know, it's like all of these financial advisors are like, you know, risk appetite, you need more risk, you know, risk is good. And, you know, forget that risk is actually a set of trade-offs. You know, risk itself is value neutral, although certain people are more likely to see it as negative or positive. And I think that either extreme, depending on the perspective you come from, could really benefit from balancing that out.
Great. Second one here, this is interesting. I think I can tell where this is coming from. This is from somebody who's actually working in the pharmaceutical industry. And the question is in Europe again. And the question is, what should leaders do to mitigate risk? And when should leaders embrace risk?
It's a great question. And I think it starts with leaders understanding their approach to risk. And I think that there's sort of a stereotype that leaders tend to be very risk-seeking. And I, in some ways, I don't like risk-seeking either, in the same way that I don't like risk-averse, because it involves, you know, all things being equal. You know, I think a good leader looks at both the opportunities and the dangers in a risk and balances that out, you know, making sure that you are taking the risk that you need for innovation and for growth. And to be honest, I think one of the reasons that people don't always deal with gray rhino risks is that they feel like heading off a risk is risky in and of itself. You know, they're more afraid of doing the wrong thing than they are of doing nothing like everybody else around them. So I think that good risk leadership involves self-awareness. And once you have that, try to really run with your strengths and make up for your weaknesses. Make sure that your team complements your risk fingerprint. And then it involves listening and risk empathy. You know, what's your company culture? Do you reward people for speaking up and saying, hey, watch out, red flag here? Or do you punish them? And whether you yourself do it, you know, what do the person's peers do? You know, do they ostracize the person who always sticks up their head? Do they bang them down like a nail that's sticking up? And, you know, when you have a better sense of the risk fingerprint of your organization, then you ask yourself, is this really where we should be? I think certain types of organizations tend to skew in one direction or another. You know, like a big company where, you know, people have been working there for decades, and many of them came from generations where the safe thing to do and the smart thing to do was to go and find a company to work for that's going to give you a pension and all sorts of benefits. You know, that was the safest thing to do. And then today you've got all of these startups and younger and much more aggressive companies that have sometimes too much of a risk appetite. So figure out what the culture is and whether that's aligned with where you want to go. And then you can make a lot more tactical decisions about what needs to happen to make sure that you're aligned with the strategic direction that you want to go.
Some great insights there. And a really good segue actually into the next question, which comes from the United States, somebody who works in the technology sector. It's about Generation Z. Do you think young professionals have a different risk appetite or risk tolerance than other generations?
Oh, I love that question. I write regularly for Strategy and Business Magazine and wrote a piece about millennials.
Right.
And there were all these headlines and reports about, you know, millennials being risk averse that make my head want to explode. And, you know, right. I talked to a financial advisor, Dennis Nolte, who was also quoted in the book, who was, you know, making the point of, okay, if you've got a stock market that's looking pretty toppy and you're paying close to 10% on your student loans, which means that, you know, paying that down gives you an implied 10% return right away, what's the quote unquote risk averse decision or not? Or even, you know, you look at, you know, stocks versus bonds, that little wheel that I got when I started my career and opened my first 401k. I don't know if they give you that anymore, but, and this idea that, okay, stocks are riskier than bonds. And that's not always the case. It really depends on where each particular market is, what the other factors are. I mean, if you have interest rates at record lows when everybody's warning that inflation is coming, does that mean stocks or bonds are riskier, you know, when you're making almost nothing from the bonds and you're almost certainly looking at a principal loss in the next couple of years? So a lot of that actually goes to my point about risk so much depending on your perspective, you know, on the environment around you, on the circumstances. And millennials and you know, Gen Z even more have grown up with more of certain kinds of uncertainty and risk than earlier generations did. And of course, they had completely different types of risks as well. I mean, we're, you know, grateful my generation isn't facing a world war like, you know, like earlier generations. But I think the other part about Gen Z is that I think that they're defining success and what's at stake very differently. I attended a workshop with a bunch of Gen Zs, most of them kind of getting close to finishing college, a few of them recent graduates, who were interested in working in finance. And I asked them all, you know, what's your ideal working environment? You know, is it a startup? Is it a social enterprise? Is it a traditional corporate firm? I mean, when I was that age, I don't think, I mean, I'm not sure when the word startup became commonly used, but I sure didn't know it when I was that age. You know, I think that the people assume what you do is you go work for a bigger corporation. And very, very few of these people wanted to go work for a big traditional employer, which, you know, in my day would have been considered hugely, hugely risky. Right. But, you know, working in a smaller organization gives you more agency, more of a sense of possibility, you know, less bureaucratic sclerosis. And so I think that there are real differences. And there are also studies about millennials wanting a company where there's a path upwards, you know, where there are opportunities for learning, where there, you know, there are things that are important to them that wouldn't have occurred to me to ask at that age. And that goes to my point, which is that, you know, the risk choices that you make, what you think is worth risking, what you think is worth doing everything you can to avoid losing, that says who you are. You know, it says who you are as a person, as an employee, as a leader of a company. And, you know, when you're in HR or, you know, other hiring positions in your company, you need to think about the kind of people you're attracting and what risks they are willing to take or not. And that may mean doing some work on your corporate culture in order to attract the high quality people that you want, particularly with newer generations who've got very, very different ideas about what's risky and what's not.
That's a great point, isn't it? And probably one, unfortunately, that we're going to have to leave it on there as I'm conscious of time. Michelle, it's been fantastic talking to you. Some really strong insights there. And for people who are obviously interested in going further, you've written, as we said at the beginning, two books. The first one, The Grey Rhino, and the second one, There You Are, What You Risk. Both are available on Amazon, I guess.
Your favorite bookseller. I've been encouraging people lately to go to your favorite independent bookseller. They've been really been struggling a lot during the pandemic and have really been there for their audiences. So I think it's very important. There's more information about both of them on my website, thegreyrhino.com, the American spelling A, although the English spelling with an E will get you there as well.
Michelle, thank you very much indeed. It's an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to our guest this week, writer Michelle Walker. Next week, Steve is in conversation with Michelle Seiler Tucker, speaker, author, and CEO of Seiler Tucker, a business specializing in mergers and acquisitions. Here's a preview of that conversation.
To maximize value, the first is people. You know, you don't build a business, you build people, and people build the business for you and with you. Right. So entrepreneurs have to focus on their strengths, hire their weaknesses. You got to stop trying to do everything, put the right people in the right seats and ask the who question. Who opens the doors? Who deals with customer service, legal, marketing, manufacturing, logistics, environmental? The clue, Steve, is you should never be next to the who, because you want to build a business that can run without you.
We'll be back with the full interview in a week. In the meantime, will you consider writing a short review of the ISF podcast? Reviews are a big help when we're trying to reach new listeners. So if you do have a moment, we would be grateful for your time. Is there a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org. And while you're there, we invite you to explore our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like these. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Associate producer, Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.